Hi, this is Tamsin and Dan. Read the paper. I'm Tamsin Granger.
I'm Dan Abuhoff.
And it's March 12th, 2017. We're here in the Northeast getting ready for a big snowstorm on Tuesday. And today our lead story from the New York Times is Their True Colors. Comic mating rituals are the least of the blue-footed boobies' charms. The birds move with comic grace, like Fred Astaire and Judy Garland, as hobo swells in oversized shoes. The male faces the female and slowly lifts one foot, sets it down, and lifts the other. Check out my feet. They're blue, really blue. The female mirrors his ponderous moves. Mine are blue, too. Is this ground sticky or what? He leans over, spreads his wings wide, points his bill at the sky, and whistles breathily, as if blowing on a toy flute. She grunts and totters up to him, and they clack bills. He grabs a pebble. They clack bills again. He drops the pebble and spears a twig. Clack, whistle, grunt, whistle, and suddenly she backs away. Desperate, the male solemnly starts high-stepping again, displaying his beautiful teal-blue feet. But the courtship has fizzled, and when the female again lifts up a foot in response, it looks as if she's waving goodbye. It's dating time here for the blue-footed booby.
We don't usually start the program with that kind of sexual interlude, but we couldn't resist. It is a departure for us, but also a departure for the New York Times that felt moved when they led with that story in the Science Times last Tuesday. To explain in a section right behind the first page of the paper how to explain the blue-footed boobies on the front and home page of the New York Times amid stories about presidential smears, conspiracy theories, sexist attacks, and a setback for transgender rights. And then the New York Times explained at some length, which we will spare you. But their conclusion was, happily, that it is important to keep in mind that there is a larger world out there, not just us in our ridiculous games. Non-human animals play ridiculous games, too.
So that's the New York Times, a little on the self-conscious side.
It's a little on self-conscious side. It's hard to lead with an article and then apologize
story
for it in
the
same issue.
Oh, you know, in case you're wondering why we put this here, it's because...
So they can write things other than the news, but just barely. So we go from the steamy article about the boobies to The Americans, which is the television show that The Times, at least, describes as the best show on television. And we're apt to agree, although, you know, The Times may have a better view of this.
I don't know if I agree, but you love it.
I love it. And but the point is, we haven't seen every show. I want to get that out there. So it's not like
Every TV show.
Yeah, a lot of TV shows we have.
We have seen every episode of The Americans.
We have seen The Americans. And for those of you who haven't seen it, The Americans is crazy. The Americans is about a family that lives in a suburb in Maryland or Washington, D.C. in the 1980s, which is comprised of KGB agents. The husband and wife are KGB agents, and they have children that they brought up in the United States, but haven't really found the time or inclination to clue them in as to what the parents do for a living, at least not at the outset. So the result is these KGB agents are an arranged marriage on the part of the Soviet powers that be at the time, the KGB. And they end up, after they're planted in the U.S., 15 years later, in a household which has two Russian spies and two American children. And it's a complicated situation. What's amazing about The Americans is, and I do recommend that you take a look at it, is that you end up very much pulling for the KGB agents, which is something, because it's a fairly serious show, and they are basically enacting quite a lot of mayhem on the American institutions in power at that time, on the military, on the CIA and the like. And they're doing it in support of a cause that even they doubt. They have their own serious doubts about the motherland, the Soviet Union. And then they're at the same time, they're trying to resolve those in their own mind and bring up their children and be what they consider to be good people. And it's done so well, it's crafted so well, it's acted so well that you can't help identify with them in some degree. And it also makes the bigger point that at the end of the day, politics is personal. And that whatever actions are undertaken by the superpowers of the time, they're undertaken by real people. And they're real people with doubts about what they're doing. And if there's these Americans have anything, it's serious doubts.
So it is kind of a funny conceit. I mean, it's a story in taking place in suburban Washington. It's this little suburban family, mm-hmm. except they're spies.
They're spies.
And, you know, they're killing people mm-hmm. or they're, you know, posing as prostitutes or, you know, and all in a day's work. So there's that kind of juxtaposition. It's also a little bit funny because when the show started out, I think the sort of profile or the position or people's image of what's going on in Russia on the part of current viewers, right, was entirely different, perhaps, than now.
Yeah, I don't think that affects the show too much, though, honestly. I mean, I think it's about them, really. I
understand that, but you're looking at it from a kind of a different viewpoint.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I really don't think that that where Russia is kind of affects it.
But what other TV is
the other TV
capturing your fancy at the moment?
Not capturing my fancy, but there was an article in the paper about an English show called Country File. And, you know.
Country File.
Country File.
Like Francophile, like yeah. Anglophile, but Country File.
Well, Country File is basically, they describe it here as a weekly trip to the countryside. Okay. And what it is you have a 76-year-old host, and he has various episodes in which he goes into the countryside and interviews real people and looks at their landscape.
Country issues,
but yeah. Mostly about pastoral backgrounds. As it's described here, it's pastoral porn, shots of bare, undulating hills and deep, grassy valleys.
But the funny thing is that it is a hit
right.
in England.
It's a super hit. It is. They say that there's enormous audience. People watch it regularly. Something like every Sunday night is the number one reality show in a country that does have reality shows.
And it's some people's guilty pleasure or right. secret pleasure.
Including the royal family. And the host says, he says, I always say it's the countryside that's the star of the show. If you're not interested in what I'm saying, there's always a beautiful view behind me. So who knows? That may be the next big show that's coming to the United States.
Okay, also on TV coming this week is March Madness.
Well, before we get to March Madness, there's another story, baseball story, that's overtaken March Madness.
Really? Okay. What's that?
That's the World Baseball Classic, which usually amounts to not very much in terms of attention in the U.S.
And I never even heard of it. Yeah, and, you know, and, I never noticed it.
Well, you're right not to pay much attention to it.
But there was a stunning picture in the Times this week of a team all wearing yarmulkes.
What? I didn't even see that.
Yeah, it was a great picture.
Is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the Israeli baseball team, and that's the story. So they, for those who are not in the know in what's considered a lesser competition, the World Baseball Classic is comprised of teams from all over the world. Including the USA.
And Israel.
But in terms of ability, more notably Japan, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, these are teams which have Major League talent, the equivalent or actual Major League talent on the roster. The Israeli team is kind of coming from a great disadvantage. According to the Israeli newspapers, there are a total of 2 baseball fields in the entire country of Israel. Less than 1,000 people know how to play the game. How then can they possibly field a team? And the answer is, well, they do it by bending the rules just a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yes, they do.
Oh.
Maybe these are the rules. But the rules are this. If you're Jewish or if you're someone in your family was Jewish or you can pass, you're eligible for the Israeli baseball team.
Wait a minute. You have to be Jewish.
No, you don't have to be Jewish. You have to, if your mother was Jewish.
But it's based on religion?
There's not a Talmudic definition, but it is based on religion. It's absolutely based on religion. So what do you have? There is one Israeli player on the team. Out of 40. And everybody else is pretty much an American with some Jewish connection who is in the minor leagues. And they are players who, you know, are not famous because they're minor leaguers. So they're names like Josh Zide, Josh Goldenberg, Nate Friedman, Scott Feldman, Mike Myers. And, you know, you might say, gee, wouldn't anybody object possibly or feel that the rules are being exploited? Well, it's probably within the rules, but more to the point, I don't think anyone in Japan was excited about Josh Zide or Josh Goldenberg or too worried
concerned about them.
No, not yeah. concerned. Yeah. Not too concerned
about. Not intimidated.
About it. And now the worm has indeed turned because the Israeli team has dominated or did dominate its first round and entered its second round of play. And then it was encountered a powerhouse in Cuba and defeated them. So I don't know how this is going to end up, but the American team is on a roll. They have been quoted with throwing out slogans.
The American team is
no. I'm sorry, you caught me. It's not the American team. It's the Israeli team. Sorry.
Or the Jew crew.
They're
as
called
they
the
call
Jew
themselves.
The Jew crew. They have a mascot that's called the Mensch on the Bench, and they
is that true?
They do, and they have a slogan. When they get their first hit, they tend to yell out things like "Nobody, no hits the Jews," which is kind of different, because I think the slogan previously was "Everybody no hits the Jews," so it's a departure from previous history. But Tamsin was right in anticipating that the big story this time of year is March Madness, and March Madness.
So this is Selection Sunday, actually.
Selection Sunday later in the day. We
can't my mother told me
now.
That.
Yeah, well, we'll have your mother
my
on
mother,
sometime.
My mother pays attention.
When we get into deep analysis of the sports, your mother is going to be the first guest that comes to mind. She'll be here. Well, we'll host her here for some length of time. And take a look at her bracket. But, of course, that's the competition among collegiate basketball teams.
You know that Trump is not doing a bracket.
Yes, I know that Trump. And Trump would be against a tournament because every year there's an article that shows that American productivity takes a dive if you take account of the time that people
spent
at work
spend. Filling out brackets.
Filling out brackets and all talking right. about basketball.
Shocking behavior.
And yet it's still going to continue. Okay. So do we care about college basketball and why should we? And the answer is interesting. The answer is that most people, to the extent they pay attention to basketball, it's pro basketball at this point, and that's the dominant part of the sport. People talk about the Golden State Warriors, their high-flying, sort of up and down the court playing, three-point shots, scoring 150 points. Seth Curry, they've captured the imagination of basketball fans out there. So where does that leave college? What's interesting about college as opposed to the pro basketball is this. Pro basketball is a player's league. They're terribly talented, but you can't coach them. And here's what I mean. If you have any children who are in their young 20s, it's tough to tell them what to do. It turns out it's even tougher to tell them what to do if they're not your children and if they're making $16 million a year. That's what they've learned in the NBA. So you can't coach them too terribly much. But in college, you can. Mm-hmm. And you have to. And the reason is that the talent in college is not fairly spread. It's not an even game. And that's what you see in the tournament, particularly in the first rounds. You see terrifically talented teams playing teams that aren't so terrifically talented. And how can they possibly compete? Uh-huh. And the answer is...
Coaching.
Coaching. There right. you go. Yeah.
I'm listening. I'm listening.
Good. Coaching. Coaches have systems. It's a coaches' league. And that takes us to one of the greatest examples of that, which was written up in the journal yesterday, which was Pete Carril and the Princeton teams in the 1980s and 1990s.
Of course, we personally got to watch this live.
We did.
Got yes, to watch because it. He was the coach. When
he
we
was
were
the coach
Princeton.
When we were
yeah.
in school.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we're going to focus on just a little bit afterwards, but he played the same system. At the time, it turns out, revisionist history has changed the view of what Pete Carril was doing. He was viewed then as someone who slowed up the game to some degree and tried to equalize things when he played a more powerful team. Turns out that's not what he had in mind. It turns out what he was doing was orienting his team to take three-point shots. Now, three-point shots, just quickly, three-point shots are longer shots. Why do you take three-point shots? And it all has to do with math, which, as you can imagine, Princeton had a little slight edge on. And that's this. The expected value of a three-point shot is based on the value and the likelihood it goes in. So, if you have a three-point shot with a 30% likelihood of going in, the value is 0.9. If you have a two-point shot with a 40% value of going in, the value was 0.8. The answer is take three-point shots.
Three-point shot, yeah.
So now people say to Pete Carril, gee, the NBA is taking a lot of three-point shots. Is that something that was anticipated by your team? Quote Pete Carril, you'd have to be blind as a bat not to notice that. Not that he's not taking credit for this, but there are some stats to back that up. So in the years, in the 1990s, when the NBA was taking 20% of its shots from the three-point line, and the NCAA in college was taking 29.2%, Pete Carril's team took 48.2%. And all this culminated in the game that was played in 1996 in the first round between the Princeton Tigers and the UCLA Bruins, UCLA having won the tournament the previous year. And it's a famous game because Princeton won the game. And people like to think about Princeton slowing up the game, and that's how they won it, but that's not how they won it. They won it because that day they took 27 of 46 shots from the three-point line, and that's how they beat UCLA.
Right.
Why is this even more important than just that game in 1996? Here's why. There's a famous picture that was taken at the end of the game, in which one of the players in UCLA is so frustrated, he's biting a towel, biting hard on a towel. Turns out that player's name is Bob Myers. Bob Myers today is the general manager of the Golden State Warriors. So what goes around comes around. What we learn is this. Number one, it's good to watch the NCAA because the players care so much that they bite on towels. That's point one.
Right.
Point two is, it's interesting to watch because every team, particularly the lesser teams, bring its own system, and you get to see strategy on the court in a very clear way. And number three, at least as basketball is concerned, sometimes you get to see the future. And maybe we'll see that this year.
All right. So, moving right along, back to...
books. We want to talk about books.
Yeah, let's talk about some books. I read a couple of interesting books in the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition this week. First one, Fallen Glory by James Crawford. And it is a book that talks about toppled architecture, telling the lives and deaths of history's greatest buildings. And I bring it up for the general public because the review here, and it's written by, the review is written by Mr. Petrosky, a professor of civil engineering and history at Duke, and he says, "I savored every page. At no time was I tempted to rush through or skip ahead. The writing is that good, and
wow.
Each one of the author's subjects is fascinating, if idiosyncratic." So, you know, we notice from time to time that it doesn't matter what the subject matter is of a book or a movie,
right,
sometimes,
right.
If it's just that well written.
And savor every page is up there, yes.
So he covers a lot of fun buildings, the Tower of Babel, Hippodrome of Constantinople, talks a little bit about what's happening in Palmyra, Syria today, the Bastille, a lot of famous buildings and what happens to them. Also brings up the Panopticon, which is, it was a design by a philosopher and sort of social theorist, Jeremy Bentham.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Who's interesting because he willed that his body be encased in a glass case.
Really?
Yes.
Jeremy Bentham was a great philosopher.
So if you go to...
utilitarian philosophy.
Right, exactly. Yeah. If you go to the University College at London, you can still see his body in a glass case.
Something like
yes,
no,
it's
he
called
was,
the Otto Icon.
He's a mentor of John Stuart Mill, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't know that much about him, but the Panopticon, the idea was... you would have, it's like a wagon wheel, and in the center you would have a tower.
Yeah.
And from that you could observe everything that's going around on all around that tower.
Yeah.
So it could be applied to hospitals or prisons.
Yeah, oh no, yeah, I've heard
okay.
about that. In
and
prisons,
so
yes.
Eastern State Penitentiary, to some extent, in Philly, was designed with that in mind.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
But what the... reviewer and the author bring up here is that it's a physical design of surveillance, and surely it seems that we live in kind of a permanent panopticon today with the idea of all the surveillance on our daily lives,
right.
Which derives from a simple idea in architecture. So speaking of falling buildings, there was also an article in the Wall Street Journal about the possibility of the buildings in Florence falling down, because right. there have been so many earthquakes mm-hmm. recently in Italy, and there is so much at Florence that would be at risk there, and including things like the famous statue of David by Michelangelo that's in the Academia. And a couple years ago, the minister, the Italian minister, announced $200,000 that were being devoted to creating a better kind of stand, mm-hmm. plinth, for David in case of an earthquake. Mm-hmm. Although the current director of the Galleria della Camera, the Academia, Cecily Hallberg, says, yeah, that's great, except that if the roof of the Academia falls down, what difference does it make if we have a state-of-the-art plinth that right. he's standing on? So that's one interesting...
All right. No, I think that is interesting. Just quickly, there was a review in the Times about a book called The Brain Defense. And this is just kind of a bizarre story. So a man named Weinstein commits a murder, kills his wife, throws her off a building. It's kind of grisly murder. And they have him dead to rights, except for one thing. They take an MRI of his skull, and the defense lawyer notices that it looks like, that, as described here, there's a in his brain, there's a gaping space the size of an orange in the left frontal lobe. The region that is generally agreed governs impulse control, and that's because it's revealed that he has a cyst there. So he's missing the part of the brain that has impulse control. That might be a defense. It's not tested because when this lawyer goes to the prosecuting attorney, he's so concerned about this defense, they agree to a lesser charge. It's just manslaughter. And now you have legal implications for an MRI.
Okay.
So that's, number one, it's controversial because there were other circumstances that suggested that this fellow, Weinstein, had motivation to get rid of his wife, largely financial. But beyond that, it turns out in the story here, that it's not much of a defense. And the reason is that what happens is when this fellow Weinstein comes up for parole, he doesn't get it. And that's because the parole board says, well, how can we let you out on the street? There is a piece of your frontal lobe missing. God knows what you're going to do. In any event, that's in The Brain Defense by Kevin Davis.
Okay, and one other book you might look for... it's called Down City by Leah Carroll. And it's just, it's about Leah Carroll's parents. Her mother is murdered when she's 4 years old in the process of buying cocaine. Her father drops dead when she's 18. It's a poignant story, really, that takes place in Providence, Rhode Island, a place that has been through... you know, kind of some interesting transitions over there.
Yeah, it's been rough.
So, anyway, it sounds like an interesting, if not personal and sad book, so.
Okay.
Maybe worth taking a look at.
All right. March 8th was International Women's Day, which I have to say I didn't really, hadn't paid much attention to, but I did catch an article in the Times that says that, you know where they pay?
Well, in our house.
In our house, every day is
every
International
day
Women's
is,
Day.
Every day is Women's Day.
That's for sure. But where they pay attention to it, perhaps even more than they pay attention to it in our house, is Russia. According to the newspaper, The Times, on that day, Wednesday, Russians love International Women's Day. Flower sellers love the holiday. March 8th is the largest single sales day in Russia for flowers, from mom-and-pop shops to wholesale markets, and in particular...
All right.
Dutch farmers who sell the flowers to Russia. And it's not as if they don't have Valentine's Day in Russia. They do. And it's sort of celebrated, but it's not considered at the same level of International Women's Day because, from the Russians' perspective, it's too cloyingly romantic to encompass the full range of ways that women should be appreciated. So I think this raises an issue for folks like me for next year, and it's a familiar issue. And as you approach holidays like Valentine's Day or Women's Day, I mean, how do you go? Do you go with cloyingly romantic, or do you go with ways of appreciating women the full range of ways that they should be appreciated?
I think any time there's the possibility of bringing flowers, you bring them.
Bring them?
Yeah. And as luck would have it, you did bring me flowers on March 8th.
I read the newspaper.
Right. But I think it's interesting. You were telling me about this, and you mentioned that the sale of flowers to Russia has a real impact on the Dutch economy.
Oh, it's a huge part of the Dutch economy, so much so that when there were some strained relations between the Dutch and Russians a few years ago, the Russians made a point of not buying Dutch flowers, and the Dutch suffered. So they kind of fixed those relations up. Maybe they sent flowers. Who knows? And they're back in business on International Women's Day. There were a couple of interesting obituaries this week.
Yeah.
And the one that jumped out...
For both of us.
For both of us.
And it was just, it wasn't even a full obituary. It was just one of the notices.
So this is, I think this is, it's fascinating. The Times and I both spotted this because we don't always read the notices. And these are the ones paid for privately by the folks who are related to those who had passed away.
Right. We often read these because they can be interesting and poignant and quirky, even though these are not world famous.
Well, the woman that we're focusing on here is a woman who passed away named Edith Fink, who's described as a beloved mother and so on from Woodmere, Long Island. But then the point is made here, quote, for 50 years, Edith Fink's closest friends were Joan and Stan Lee, who used Edith as an inspiration for the Fantastic Four's Sue Richards.
Who was
one of the Fantastic Four. The Fantastic Four comprised of four figures with superpowers. Reed Richards, Sue Richards.
So she's Mrs. Fantastic?
She's Mrs. Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. And I will say the photo, she looks pretty fantastic.
She does look fantastic. I think that's what drew me to read that one.
And she was originally, since you asked, she was originally known not just as Mrs. Richards. She needs more than that. She has a superpower. She could turn invisible. And she was originally known as the Invisible Girl. But because Marvel moved with the times, her name was changed to the Invisible Woman.
Ah, all right.
So that was a notable obituary. Okay. Another notable obituary had to do with Joseph Rogers, 97, who ran the Waffle House. The Waffle Houses that you see, they're ubiquitous all over the country, particularly in the South. What's interesting is this. There are 1,900 Waffle Houses, 80% of them company-owned, so many so that FEMA, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency of the United States, tracks the impact of disasters like hurricanes in places like the South by seeing whether the local Waffle House is open, which raises the question whether those Waffle Houses are really, you know, run by the federal government, whether they're actually out there to track things like hurricanes and whatever, because there's no other way you can have 1,900 restaurants, as far as I'm concerned. But in any event, we can investigate that
another day. You're making it funny, right? You don't really think that they're
Who knows?
Run by
at this point, there are so many rumors. I don't really know.
All right, what else you got?
And the final one is Fred Weintraub. Fred Weintraub, he ran the Bitter End, and he's just an odd character. Bitter End being a nightclub in New York.
Well, it's really a coffee house.
Coffee house, that's better.
Okay. He didn't even have a liquor license.
Didn't have a liquor license.
And yet he made this, you know, a really important venue for folk singers.
Yeah, I mean, he had no background. He was in some retail business in the Lower East Side. And then he got up one day, he left home. He's not necessarily the greatest guy in the world, left his family behind for a freewheeling life, including playing piano in a bordello, operating a fishing boat in Cuba, roaming Europe. And then he goes to Greenwich Village and he opens this place, which is just a hole in the wall, almost literally, downtown. And he attracts folks like Bob Dylan, Harry Chapin, Neil Diamond, Bette Midler, Carly Simon, and a whole bunch of comics like Dick Cavett and George Carlin. And it becomes an institution. And then he parlays that into his being behind the movie Woodstock, and persuading the movie studio to actually bankroll Woodstock, which they did. And then it culminates in him becoming more of a movie producer behind Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon. And there actually is a factual movie that they make about Bruce Lee in which they want to have a character, namely Fred Weintraub, and he plays himself. And they ended up cutting his part out. When they asked him about that later, he said, "Well, I'm not surprised. I'm not a professional actor. And it's an awfully difficult part to play." So he had some self-awareness as to he was sort of a piece of work, but a very interesting life.
So, you know, when I was looking at the Wall Street Journal this weekend they give you some recipes. This week they're meatless, and they're based on the idea that fermentation enhances flavor. And, of course, it's the usual kind of recipes. You read the recipe, I read the recipe, and you think, yeah, they really don't have enough information here to actually make this dish. Yeah. So, you know, so that's disappointing. But I told you, I look at the Wall Street Journal recipes as really food porn, recipe yeah. porn. Right. You look at them, they look delicious, they're enjoyable to read about. You don't actually try to make them. And thinking about food a little bit more in the New York Times travel section, there was an article about why food in the airplane tastes bad. And it's not just because it's bad. It's because there's all kinds of things going on, apparently, that kind of hinder you from tasting things when you're up in the air. Apparently, our sensitivity to sweet and salty food drops by about 30%. When you're up in the airplane, so that sweet and salty things don't taste so good. What does taste good is anything with umami. That's the fifth sense, the sort of savory sense that you find in, well, things like Worcestershire sauce, anchovies, etc. So that the top-selling mixed drink in the air is Bloody Marys. They sell more Bloody Marys because that has Worcestershire sauce in it. You know, things like beer foams too much, so they're repackaging beer. Apparently, if you take some of the CO2 out of beer and put it in a champagne bottle instead of a beer bottle or can, you get better beer. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting that there are things that actually affect your taste that don't have anything to do with
crummy food. So that's why the airline crummy food is not
yeah.
good after
It's
all.
Not just crummy. It actually could be good food. It still wouldn't taste good.
Okay. In the era of movies, not too many movies open this time of year, but there was an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal that noted the fact that the new King Kong movie, which is, let's just say, lukewarm, stars Brie Larson. Brie Larson, some of you may remember, won the Oscar last year for Best Actress in a movie called Room, which is as close to an art movie as you're going to see at the Academy Awards. She spent the whole movie in a room with her son. It was a challenging movie to make and to watch, but the fact of the matter is she was considered a wonderful actress from that movie, and now she's in King Kong. So it's fair to ask yourself, is that the way it goes?
Why, Brie? Why?
That's another way of putting it. That's a more direct way of putting it. Why, Brie?
Yeah, and it turns out.
That's the way it's done. So what the Wall Street Journal did, because so you don't have to do it at home, is to make a list of prominent actors listing their the year of their Oscar and their next movie, and it turns out that's the way it happens. So we have Helen Mirren winning her Oscar in 2006 and following up the next year with the movie National Treasure, Book of Secrets. You have Jamie Foxx as Ray, following it up with Stealth in 2005. You have Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Capote, you'll recall that. The next year, Mission Impossible 3. Halle Berry, follow up Monster's Ball with Die Another Day. And it goes on and on and on, with right through Cate Blanchett, going from Blue Jasmine to How to Train Your Dragon 2. So, you know, listen, the girl's got to eat. We understand that that's the way that's done, but the next time you're watching some cringeworthy speech, acceptance speech of the Academy Awards about art and whatever, just think about what that next project is and sort of puts it all in perspective.
But they probably signed up for that next project long before.
It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah, they knew they were going to be Oscar winners.
But speaking of next projects, what's going on the boards?
On the boards, Broadway.
Broadway.
Broadway. Well, you know what? There's a lot of stuff going on. And we feel it's up to us to...
Up to us, because no one else is
people,
up to this. Yes.
Let people know about this.
Yeah.
So, Hello Dolly's coming, right?
Yes.
With Bette Midler.
Right.
I know you're skeptical about that.
Yes.
But, you know, people are excited, very excited.
I'm skeptical about that, too.
We've mentioned War Paint a couple times, which is about big divas and has big divas in it. Also, we noticed that a production of Little Foxes by Lillian Hellman is coming along with Laura Linney and Cynthia Nixon, among others. Also, in terms of musicals, Bandstand is going to be opening. That's about swing music. It takes place in 1945 with Laura Osnes, a disappointment in Cinderella, to me. Beth, I don't know how to say her name, Level?
Yeah, Beth Level, yes.
Level, and Corey Scott from Newsies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bandstand sounds like...
jukebox musical.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's got a particular demographic in mind.
Okay.
So we'll see. Also, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Christian Borle. Now, you said that's a big hit in
London. Yeah, in London, yes.
So people have high hopes.
As is Groundhog Day, which is a big hit in London.
Oh, really?
Even a bigger hit in London, I believe.
Okay.
And up for a lot of awards. Groundhog Day, obviously the movie with Bill Murray, now a musical.
Right. Who did you say is in there? Carl?
Oh, Andy Carl.
Andy Carl.
Andy Carl, who we saw on Broadway in, what was that? But it wasn't, he was in Rocky.
Okay. And 6 Degrees of Separation. It's a revival.
Right.
Of this play that...
John Guare wrote.
Yeah. With the... was originally with Stocker Channing.
Exactly, yeah.
And, but this is going to star Allison Janney.
Mm-hmm.
Big article about Philippa Sue, who's opening in Amelie, based on the movie.
Which turns out to be her favorite movie. She's long been interested in doing something on Amelie, which is a coincidence, I guess.
Yeah, it was an interesting article because it detailed how she, you know, was involved. Well, she was a star of... in Hamilton,
right,
Mrs. Hamilton.
But she had previously done the workshop for The Great Comet,
right.
So she was
involved in developing all these
all
three,
three of
different
these shows, and
so,
she couldn't do all of them.
So she seems to be quite the Broadway force,
yes,
at the moment.
Right.
And also, there's a play of 1984 coming to Broadway soon.
So we'll see.
So, yeah,
we'll see.
Lots
the way
of stuff
it normally works is that a lot of plays tend to open right up until the deadline for the Tonys, and that's April 27th. So keep your eyes open.
So, yeah, so, yeah.
All right. So, we'll close with a taking a look at the Times Magazine section article on the 25 songs that tell us where music is going. We're only going to cover one.
And yeah, the one that caught your eye.
Is You Want It Darker by Leonard Cohen. And Leonard Cohen, of course, passed away this year. Well, Leonard Cohen is a very spiritual person. He's experimented quite a bit, spent a lot of time in Hinduism. But it turns out he's Jewish, and he came back to Judaism, and he came back to the temple where his grandfather was the president of the temple. And as he knew that he was nearing the end of his days, he wrote to the cantor of the temple for his help with his choir to help record one of the songs. And the letter apparently said...
So he wanted to use
the
temple choir.
The temple choir for...
In his...
In Leonard Cohen's recording.
For his album. Okay.
Right. And the letter says, and this is just interesting, to the cantor from Cohen, may your voice reach that place and bring down the blessings. And the cantor writes about Cohen, he can't say anything normally, can he? Which is clearly the case. But in any event, they did the recording together. It's on the album, and the lyric is, but it's written in the scriptures, and it's not some idle claim. You want it darker, we kill the flame. And here's a verse from Leonard Cohen's song, Everybody Knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows that the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. And everybody knows we'll be back next week.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.